Okay, thank you, David. It's a pleasure being here. I come almost every year, I think, to Australia. And Australians are nice, even the going. So I'll say a few words about, you know, my own neighborhood. In the Middle East, we have you know, certain trends, which are partly old, partly new. The old trends are simple. Some of the states are disintegrating because they lose monopoly over use of force. This is what the state is all about. There is their militia, there is no state. So, you know, we've seen Lebanon having a militia, we've seen Iraq disintegrating into different groups, Kurdish, Shiite, Sunnis. we've seen Syria, of course, shambles. Now, of course, are trying with the help of the Russians and the Iranians to put it back together. I doubt if they'll be fully successful. In Libya, there was once a state, but Americans decided that Gaddafi is not good enough, and we see the results. It's a big mess with a lot of militias there. Somalia, Yemen, we have a lot of states that lose their state characteristics. And this is, of course, a fertile place for terrorists, for people with weapons. So we have a lot of this in our area. Also, another clear trend is growing influence of political Islam. Since the Iranian Revolution in 79, when one of the big countries became radical Muslim with a clear jihadist agenda, say a few words more about Iran, we've seen Islamists growing influence, and actually anywhere there is a free election, the Islamists are taking over because they are successful in providing services that the state has failed to provide. They are building schools, they are giving social services, they build hospitals, and generally they are seen as more honest than the corrupt and the secular leadership. So when we have elections, they win. Maybe fortunately we don't have too many elections in the Middle East, and also if they win an election, we know this is the last election, of course. We all know in Egypt there was a free election, the Muslim Brotherhood took over, Morsi was the president for a year, and luckily for all of us, the military decided to have a coup d'etat, and Assisi is in power. And the Islamists, of course, are very anti-Israeli. In theological terms, they are not willing to accept a Jewish state. They are fighting us. You know, they are fighting us. Hezbollah is fighting us. Hamas is fighting us in Gaza. So those are old trends. I think that most trends will not end. You know, this is something that has become a permanent feature of the Middle East. What has changed is the status of Iran. Iran is a large country. Iran is over 80 million people. There are three important countries in the Middle East with large populations and traditions. This is Iran, Persia, it's Turkey, and Egypt. Those are the largest states, and they all have a past in which they ruled part or all of the region. Iran is a large country with money. They have oil. So they have a capacity to exert influence in the region by mere magnitude. Now, on top of it, we have, of course, the Persian identity, another layer of the identity of this country, which is an imperial identity. Persia was an empire, and they want to, their basic instinct is to go back to the Chadesh Yamenu Kekedem, to go back to what they used to. And on top of this, you know, there are several layers to Iran of today, but there is a Shiite-Sunni divide. You know, there are two basic streams within Islam, the Sunni, which is a majority, and Shiite is a minority. And the Shiite, Iranians are, Persians are Shiite, and the Shiites have been discriminated against for hundreds of years. And they have a grudge against the Sunnis that rejected their teachings and discriminated against them, even in places where they are the majority. In Iraq, for example, they were a majority. In Lebanon, they were a plurality, you know, they were the largest ethnic group. So they have a grudge against you know, the Arab states. And on top of it, in 79, as I mentioned, there is a revolutionary regime with plenty of energy. And they have a jihadist vision of bringing Islam all over, first of all, the Muslim world, their version of Islam, and afterwards expanding the rule of Islam as it's written in the scriptures. They are fundamentalists, the world. According to their views, the world eventually will have to be ruled by a Muslim entity. They speak about you know, Andalusia. What's Andalusia? Spain. Yes, it was ruled by they have a presence, by the way, the Persians have a presence also in the Balkans, which was once ruled by the Ottomans, also a Muslim entity. So they are expansionist. And what we see from them in recent years, a willingness to use force, and use of force is part and parcel of the rules of the game in our region, but they are not shy about it, and to take risks. They are taking risks, which other, you know, most other countries are risk averse, including and we have a country that it's more difficult to predict how it's going to behave. And the Iranians are actually challenging us at the three main levels, at the nuclear level, at the conventional level, at the, what they call the subconventional level. At the nuclear challenges, and it's clear, they tried to build a bomb. They reached an agreement in 2015, July 2015, it's called JCPOA, and which is very, very beneficial to them. Because it is several weaknesses. First weakness is the issue of inspection or verification. It's a very weak inspection regime. Actually, they declare a certain site as military site, they can block any inspection by the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna that is in charge of inspection. Also, the agreement itself allows them to continue research and development in certain nuclear areas, for example, centrifuges, which are crucial for enriching uranium and getting fissionable material, which is the material for a bomb. And they have already, within a very short time, we're talking about 2 years, they have developed centrifuges that are 10 times as fast as before, which will allow them, when the agreement expires, to acquire much faster the material for a bomb. The third weakness is that it's clear that the agreement is not forever. It expires in 8 years, or 10 years. So, of course, the West doesn't think what will happen after. You know, they are short-sighted and made an agreement and will be okay afterwards. But I'm not sure they'll be okay afterwards. And finally, another clear weakness of the agreement is that the willingness of the West to give legitimacy to the nuclear program and to eliminate the sanctions, the economic sanctions, is not linked to any condition on the foreign policy and defense policy of the Iran, and this is why they continue to build long-range missiles, which can carry eventually nuclear weapons. And again, this is, they are okay. They do not violate any part of the agreement. So it was a terrible agreement, and they take advantage of it. And of course, if they have a nuclear weapon, they can get a lot of influence, because people are afraid of countries with nuclear weapons, particularly countries that don't have an image of being a rational actor, taking into consideration human life, human rights. All those things are, of course, totally inexistent in Iranian political culture. Also, from an Israeli point of view, the nuclear threat is clear, but if they develop nuclear weapons, then Hezbollah and Hamas have greater freedom of action against us, because they can operate within, you know, under a nuclear umbrella. And this is quite a problem. Another threat is at the subconventional level, you know, terror, sending missiles, and this primarily Lebanon and Gaza. In Lebanon, they have over 100,000 missiles, which some of them are short range, and this is, by the way, our main problem. Some of them are long range, but those are less of a problem for us, because they can be more easily detected, and by preemptive strike you can eliminate them. And although there is a lot of them, so, and there is greater accuracy of their missiles, they are developing greater accuracy, which poses a problem for us, because for example, they can hit all our power stations. And in modern era, you know, if you don't have electricity, you are in big trouble. And this is a real threat as a result of their you know, missile arsenal. And Gaza is in a similar position. They don't have as many, but they are gaining, building more and more. They have succeeded in moving via the Sinai, Sudan, Sinai, missiles from Iran, which are dismantled and afterwards put together in Gaza. For the short-range missiles, we have to some extent a solution. This is a Iron Dome system, which is a very effective system and can identify the trajectory of each missile and shoot only at those missiles that are threatening population centers, or to be you know, more accurate, strategic installations. We don't have too many Iron Dome batteries. We need much more. And they are basically designed to defend the strategic installations, such as power stations, ports, certain centers of command. So the population is of secondary importance, and it will cost much money to build more Iron Domes. This is Israeli technology. You can do it on our own. Mid-range missiles, we have a second tier, you know, the David Sling, an Israeli-American project. It's Israeli mines and American money, and it is we cannot export it, for example. Iron Dome we can export. And some of the David, you know, David Sling is produced in the United States, and we buy it with American money that is provided to us as military assistance. So we use our money for producing stuff in the United States. This is an arrangement in many areas. We managed somehow to deal with a subconventional. I think that a nuclear Iran is very dangerous, and probably the only way to stop Iran is to attack the nuclear installations. And this is doable, in my view, not easy. And it takes political determination. And so far, it's not there. So, so far, Israel is hesitant in using this option. Netanyahu is very cautious, he's not trigger happy. Maybe he's over cautious. The conventional threat, however, is interesting because for many years, due to the disintegration of the Arab states, we saw that this threat is no longer relevant. The Syrian army disintegrated, the Iraqi army disintegrated. But now there is probably the moment when it might re-emerge. And we might see again the, what we call the Eastern Front. Syria, the civil war may end soon. And then they will go back to build a military force. This time, you know, with Russians, the Russians are there, and Iranian support. The Iranians have a clear interest in building a Syria that is under their control. Actually, the Syrians have been their most loyal ally in the Middle East, despite the fact that Assad is not an Islamist. They were given, you know, a kosher certificate as Islamists some time ago by the Iranians. They are a sect, Alawi sect, which is, who knows, there are Christian elements there, there are Muslim elements there, but as a matter of convenience, they are considered now, and they are happy to be considered as Muslims. And they are in the Iranian pocket for so many years. So we may see a resurgence of the Syrian army, we may see also a takeover of Jordan. Jordan is under the Hashemites, ruled by the Hashemites. They are good rulers, which means in Middle Eastern terms, ruthless. And who knows? It may change. I actually commissioned a study at my new institute on Iranian influences in Jordan. And there is greater weaknesses in the Hashemite regime than before. So if Jordan falls and Syria is there, it's this is part of the Eastern Front, and I wouldn't be surprised if in Saudi Arabia, further south, will be destabilized by the Iranians. The area where most of the oil is the Eastern Province, just along the coast of the Persian Gulf, and it's populated by Shiites. It's a continuation of Iraq, actually. And they have made already inroads within that population. Some of the Iranian agents were caught, some of them are Arabs, executed by the Saudis. So Saudis are aware that this is a problem, but who knows, they may destabilize, and then Saudi Arabia would become also a part of this Eastern Front. Now, as a result of these three challenges, Israel faces now a new problem. What kind of war to prepare for? To build a force, it takes time. You have to build, to procure, build the proper equipment. You have to train the soldiers for a scenario. You know, militaries are blunt instruments. They do only what they know to do. There is little flexibility with this type of large organizations. So they have to train. They have to train on a certain scenario, and only afterwards they can do it successfully. Israel doesn't have the money to prepare for every scenario possible. So there will be a little bit of that, a little bit of that, and you are taking risks. And the more scenarios you have, you basically have more risks if one of them really is being realized. we may need a larger military. A part will be trained for this scenario, a part will be trained for another scenario. All this costs a lot of money. We have another challenge in the East Mediterranean. You know, if you take a look at the East Mediterranean, it has become largely an Islamic lake. Libya, Islamic militias. Egypt was ruled for over a year by the Muslim Brotherhood. They may come back. If there are free elections, I'm sure they'll be coming back. In Sinai, we have a myriad of Islamist militias that are threatening the Egyptian regime, are threatening the Suez Canal. Tens of Egyptian soldiers and officers are being killed every week. We are helping Assisi in this struggle, but they may be successful. Further on the coast, it's Gaza. Gaza is Hamas. Further on the coast is Israel, the Jewish states, and further north is Lebanon. Lebanon is ruled by Hezbollah, and a proxy of Iran. Further north is Syria, which is not Islamist per se, but it's also a proxy of Iran. And as a result of the civil war, there are many still remnants of Islamic militias there. Further north is Turkey. Turkey is Islamist. Interestingly, two of the most important Middle Eastern states, Turkey and Iran, are Islamists. Erdogan is a Turkish version of Islam, of the Muslim Brotherhood. For us, the East Mediterranean is very important. Over 90% of our international trade goes via the Mediterranean. And in the recent years, we found gas, which is very important to prop up our economy. Will not become Qatar. This type of amount. It's a lot of money there, and we'll have to defend it. Of course, I'm here in a lawyer firm. You know, you don't deal with Hezbollah with a lawyer. You know, that's not. They shoot. So.
I don't know. You got Shurat Adin. They seem to be quite successful.
Against Hezbollah?
I don't know about it.
Come on. That's. The Americans, you have to kill the bad guys. You don't go to court. Come on, that's. Well, I'm not belittling what they're doing, but what is important to see them dead. And if they're in jail, some of them are sent out to jail because of kidnapping. So even if they're in jail, it's not. It's temporary. We need a larger navy, which is also costly. We are preparing, we bought some German ships, we have also submarines on the way, which are also a strategic weapon in the context of Iranian nuclear bomb. So this is a serious challenge. And I'll end, which is probably, in my view, the most important challenge, and this is to maintain social cohesion in Israel. Israel is not as divided as it's portrayed in the press or by the left. Actually, there is great social cohesion in Israel, and people are ready to pay sacrifices in order to fight for the state. But we shouldn't take it for granted. And we have a regular army, not a mercenary army. So it's very important for the people to understand that the next war, which might come, is a war of no choice. You have no choice but to do what, to use force, despite the casualties. And a next war will be very costly, because with the thousands of missiles, population centers will be hit. There should be an understanding that the price is right. Also, don't have the illusions that Israel can easily emulate the 67 victory. 67 was quick. We came out victorious. Now the circumstances have seriously changed. Therefore, again, mm-hmm. it's going to be costly. And in order to be able to conduct such a war, you need the people behind you. Israel is a strong state. Israel, I believe, can do it. There is a lot of support for the government. And Bezrat Hashem, with the help of God, will win the next one. Okay, I think it's 20 minutes.
So let's open it up for questions.
Yeah, sure.
So, in light of what you said and the current circumstances, does Israel sort of sit back and wait to react, or, in your view, should it be proactive and sort of take the fight up to Iran and possibly Lebanon as well?
I indicated clearly that I think we should preempt in Iran against the nuclear challenge.
But is there the political will in Israel to be able to do
you
that?
You ask me my opinion.
Yeah.
If Bibi will be here, ask him, you know, what you say. Again, I said maybe over cautious. But in all fairness, it's not an easy decision. And for a politician that wants to win the next election, failure is the possibility of failure.
It's catastrophic. Yeah.
So those are the, you know, the animals you are dealing with. So it's it's tricky. And I don't know.
Militarily, you said earlier that in your view you're confident of the ability to be able to successfully.
No, I said not successfully.
No, you said
this. Well, you need luck. Come on, operation.
You did say, like, I don't want to misquote. You did say that you believe that,
yeah,
militarily we have the ability to successfully attack your installations.
We can take that.
How have you formed that? Because if you read in the press, there's so many ifs, buts, and maybes about the potential to be able to successfully pull off. This is not like the Iraqi reactor where we sort of flew over Osirik and we.
That's true. It's much more difficult, and as time goes, it becomes more difficult because they improve their air defenses. But I am in contact with some military figures, I myself, a bit knowledgeable about those affairs. So I think we can do it. Being a former paratrooper, I know that there is not such a thing as an impregnable target. If you decide, you have determination, ingenuity, and readiness to pay, to take for the cost, then you do it. And I know the audience, those guys in Sharet Matkal, you tell them to go to Iran, they go. Knowing that not everybody is coming back. By the way, the strike on Osirak in 81, some pilots knew that they may not come back, and they went.
Well, they didn't know what they were doing until they got outside of Israeli airspace, so to be in fairness to them.
Well, they trained for it before.
They may have trained, but they didn't know where they were going.
But they knew it was a high risk. Yeah.
Yeah, but they had no idea where they were going. I've spoken to the...
Don't
worry about it.
So, at the same time, I advocate caution. We should not emulate the American dreams of building a democracy. We should not deal with political engineering. We should not get involved in their civil wars, But if the Iranians get close, we should hit them, yes. And not wait for, let's pray, and we should do things. But we should do it, carefully. Now we have a rather benevolent president in the United States toward Israeli actions. So, it's not Obama.
He said he's going to tear up the agreement, though.
Hmm?
He said a lot of things.
The president of America.
Yeah, well,
is it worth having an agreement that's bad or no agreement at all?
In my view, there is no better agreement. There is not such a thing. The only agreement the Iranians were ready to sign was an agreement that expires after a few years. They have patience. The American, for them, 8 years, 10 years is eternity. For a Persian, 10 years, you know, they have a long history. A history of 3,000 years. What's 10 years? Nothing. So they, in my view, they was ready to sign only the agreement that allows them that to land one day, short, that will allow them to escape serious scrutiny of their installations, and they got it. And an agreement that allows them to do other things as much as they want. Like missiles. So they got the agreement they wanted. They would have signed on anything else. So, you know, this talk about let's have a better agreement from Netanyahu and is pure nonsense. There is no better agreement.
So Trump has said he'll tear it up and Australia's following that.
Let him tear up. So what?
Why do you need something in return?
The Iranians are not going to cooperate.
That's right.
Have a clear goal, and when they look around at North Korea, you know, why should they worry? So there is not such a thing as a better agreement. This notion of a better agreement is simply totally unrealistic. Therefore, and I'm on record since 2005 that we should attack the nuclear installation because that's the only way. You cannot convince the Iranians of giving up nuclear weapons.
The sanctions failed because the Russia kept bypassing.
No, the sanctions brought them to some extent to the negotiating table because it was hurting. But they are ready to be hungry in order to get nuclear weapons. People don't get it. Well, Castro was under economic decades. And did he change his policy? No.
Maybe
there
was a step
point
in Korea.
So, countries that are determined to get a bomb, unless stopped by force, will get it.
So, what does success in the next war look like for Israel? What would be successful?
To try to shorten it.
Short duration war, yes.
Again, short, it depends, you know, what's short. You know,
well, we know what's going to happen.
As soon
as Israel gets the upper hand, the UN and Europe jumps in and says, no, ceasefire.
So, also to decapitate the leadership of the hostile organizations. Also to eliminate a large part of the arsenal.
And we just kick the can down the road for another 10 years.
Exactly. Well, how does decapitating the leadership help?
So what?
When there's no other leadership that can come in and replace them.
What do you mean there is the leadership?
There's always.
It will take some time.
It's like a hydra, you know? Cut one head
off.
Yeah,
I wrote a piece on mowing the grass. The grass is...
The grass,
but at least you have quiet for 10 years. What's don't...
I'm not underestimating
it. It's like a never-ending battle. We're just going to keep cutting the head off and go through the motions every 10 years or so.
Why not? That's what's happening. Yeah. And you should be aware that this is success.
Yeah. But you need to get it into people's heads.
Like
which Israeli people that actually represents success is people are looking for some kind of panacea, but there is no panacea.
67 victories are no longer there. I'm trying to convince the Israelis. I'm writing about it.
We're still paying the price for that victory.
Right. There is you are completely correct. Yes. Because
it's put stars into people's eyes. But this is,
Also, what does victory look like? If the best you can hope for is kick the can down the road for 10 years, that's victory.
Yeah, but 10 years for the Jewish state, fine.
But you've got to plant that seed and then cultivate that for a while in order to get the support needed in order to be able to do something like that.
In the meantime, we are blooming,
sure.
The Lebanese war, which was not a successful war, Israeli stock market went up.
There was an article in the Times of Israel today that sort of questioned whether or not there was any distinction between Lebanon and Hezbollah. Like, is there a distinct Lebanese government?
Yes, there is a distinct that is not in control. Yeah, it's a. By the way, Hamas wants to do the same. They have the Hezbollah model in mind when they do those unity talks with the PA. Basically, they want the PA to pay for all the bureaucrats and to keep the arms to do the fighting against Israel. So this is the arrangement they are looking for. And
you know,
people say, oh, it will be, we'll have a partner now, Hezbollah, Hamas. Yes.
Do you think then, I guess, sort of the religious idea of Mashiach is actually going to, is stopping people from understanding this idea of success is just kicking the can down the road for 10 years and that there'll be ultimate peace one day?
I don't know exactly what you mean by the idea of Mashiach.
I guess,
but
redemption.
I'm talking, I'm a Litvak, so...
well, then there's no discussion.
It's, you know, this idea, you know, I'm a... Rambam said, "Em b'imenu anu levenim ota Mashiach, shavud malchuyot bilvad." So, you know, between the days of Messiah and the days of today, is only, you know, having a... being, you know, subjugated to another malchut, to another sovereign. So maybe we are living now in the days of Israel. By the way, some Lubavitchers are saying it. So I don't know. I'm in a rational discourse at level, and you know, everybody's entitled to his, you know, to see a savior somewhere there.
Because it's in like the psyche of Jewish people that there's going to be perhaps one day, maybe. I mean, it's harder to cultivate this. You know, success is just.
Listen, I'm singing, you know, every Yom Atzmaut, Ve'af al pi she'itmameh bo yavo. But still, you know, come on, I'm living, and there are two levels of analysis, and I'm academic, a Litvak, so it's just. This idea is, if it gives you comfort, go ahead, you know, but I think that it's not a useful, you know, category to analyze what we should do, and because it's very mystical.
No, I agree with that.
There was a coup in Turkey, huh? I was fighting back to Turkey, there was a coup in Turkey that they flattened the asteroid. The people on the street there, are they prepared
or was there a
Turkey has gradually become more Islamic. Erdogan, you can compare Erdogan to Morsi. Erdogan is a much more sophisticated guy. Mm. He does it slowly and gradually. You know, the Turkish society is permeated by Islamic messages. He prepares cadres for...
It's fairly modern as well,
I think. Yeah, but it's primarily in the cities, and they are living. I have colleagues. I've done a lot of work on Turkey. I have a lot of friends in Turkey. Some of them are in jail now. I'll give you an example. I have some colleagues in the academia that send their children abroad, not to return, because they have lost faith in the Turkish state. This is a very bad sign if the elite, the secular elite, doesn't believe that they have a chance to win, you know, the hearts of the people. And it's still, you know, quasi-democratic. You know, he wins elections, free elections, Erdogan. He's a fantastic politician. He does it gradually.
So he's destroyed the work that Atatürk has done. He's destroyed the history of what Atatürk has done. And
oh, yeah.
It's all gone.
He speaks about another republic.
The next Ottoman Empire.
Yeah. He's open about it. The Turks were crazy. They put the picture of Atatürk in every classroom. It was, you know, a cult. You know,
so Atatürk. But this supports the Kurds and that against Turkey were aggravating.
We are not supporting the Kurds. We are tickling the Turks a little bit.
You indicated that
they've got a genuine cause.
That Jordan is quite fragile. Are you generally concerned that Hussein and his like autocracy could fall over?
Actually, it's quite good. I'll tell you a personal story. When I knew the Zaher Hassan, I didn't make a good impression. It was too civilized, but. When Abdallah became king, I invited myself to the Jordanian desk at our intelligence. And I wanted to, who knows about, what do they know? Military man. So after half an hour of briefing, I asked what in my view was the critical question. I asked, can he cut a throat? He looked at me and said, yeah. So I said, he'll be okay. And he's okay. He's okay. He doesn't even speak good Arabic, but he's okay. So he knows how to rule. But sometimes, you know, the circumstances are such that he lost some of the tribes which are critical of him. And of course, there are a lot of refugees now. Who knows, you know, what will happen with them? It's a dictatorship, and sometimes dictatorships come to an end. He's a benign. He's not a Saddam Hussein or an Assad. And this is why he has better chances to survive. But still, it's a dictator. He has a country, it's a good business.
Question on a different topic. Yeah. You mentioned three levels of nuclear, conventional, and subconventional. You didn't mention anything. What I've been hearing more and more about is about like hacking and internet and
cyber warfare.
Well, I think we are the best in the world, probably, on cyber.
Okay, so there's no need to.
No, we always have to worry about it, but I still distinguish between something you can die of, you know, directly, kinetically, you know, and cyber, you know. Cyber is, you know, it affects institutions. And cyber, you know, to some extent, we have the brains to fix it. And, you know, if you hit a tank with a missile or a certain ammunition, it's gone, that's it. You have a bank that was attacked, you can restore it, you know, unless they siphoned all the money. I'm skeptic about the great importance of cyber warfare. It is, you know, it is important, but we should keep it into proportion. You don't die from a cyber attack immediately.
You die from a bullet.
You die from a...
But they could cut out a power station.
Hmm?
They could knock out a power station.
Okay, so many centuries we lived without power.
Stark's neck was good, but didn't delight by too long. So.
You can't imagine life without power. I can understand that, but you know, it's not the end of the world. So you don't have a refrigerator. It's very important to have power. And the state can hardly function without electricity, but still, you can restore electricity. You know, you fix it. It's temporary.
Do you think it's in Israel's interest to keep propping up the Mahmoud Abbas regime and cooperating with him and Fatah?
Listen, he lives. He's on our violence. We clean the area for him. We have a clear interest. If he's not there, Hamas will be there.
There's not really that much of a difference between Fatah and Hamas. I mean, you could argue Fatah is even worse because they pretend.
Listen, Fatah doesn't shoot missiles there.
But they do attack. They are behind numerous men.
Listen, they are not tzaddikim, I'm not saying. But in terms of the damage they are doing to us, Hamas are more dangerous. And we should have no illusions. Abu Mazen is not a friend of ISIS. We prefer them divided. You know, right. What's wrong if they...
Hamas
takes over Ramallah.
Yep.
I live in Ramallah.
Then
Israel
will have a better excuse.
5 kilometers. It's Qassam Rey.
We'll have a better excuse to fight Hamas because they're...
We hit them all the time. Well, what do we need to do?
Well, with Fatah, they put on a pretense that they're interested in peace, so it's a lot harder. Israel's kind of cornered, and it's more
reluctant. Our Shin Bet is the security services are operating freely in Judea, Samaria, and we don't care. Sometimes they cooperate with us. You know, if we take a look at the number of arrests, a third of the arrests are being made by the PA security forces.
But how effective is that? Is there a revolving door?
At least for some time they are not it. Listen, there are perfect solutions. That's it, at least. Come on, be flexible. You know, do work with what you have. You know, PA cooperates to some extent with that. Fine. There are some of their policemen are shooting at us. Okay, we kill them. And, that's life in the Middle East. You cannot expect, you know, peace
there's
like
that. There's no perfect solution.
So is that the difference between a conservative think tank and a progressive think tank? You're more realistic,
right?
And they dream of peace.
Yes, they think of peace.
There's no utopian society
in the
West, man.
That's right.
That's like
I don't think there is anywhere. That's you have to recognize the limits of your dreams. Yeah, everybody wants peace. I also want peace.
I wasn't implying that there's going to be a peaceful solution, but
isn't the best?
You can. What's the alternative to control fully the West Bank? I think it's not a good arrangement. I prefer the Palestinians to take care of their education, of their garbage. We want to be back in. Most Israelis don't want to be back in. In Jenin, in Nablus, we don't want to be there. So, taking into consideration the attitudes of the Israeli society, I think this is, the status quo is not a bad arrangement. It's also not a bad arrangement for the Palestinians. They look around, what do they see? Syria, Yemen, they have a wonderful life, particularly with the settlements where they can go work and get, three times, four times as much as the salary as they can get with a Palestinian employee. So it's not perfect, I agree, but it works.
Get on with it. Suck it up.
Isn't this then the best outcome when you've got sort of both Fatah and Hamas? Because you don't have Fatah pretending to the world and allowing the world to politically pressure Israel to do certain things as happened when the PLO was sort of,
I agree.
And then on the other hand, you don't have Hamas who's completely in control everywhere and, with an immediate threat of firing missiles every day.
In my view, Hamas is not bad for the Jews.
I agree.
It shows who they are, and it's really no partner.
Okay, we'll call it there. We've run out of time. Please join me in thanking Professor Inbar for a dose of realism, shall we say.
That's what it's all about. We have to be realistic.
Yeah, Shira Malot is for Friday night before.
If anybody